This is Dave Snowden. I've got various titles ranging from professor at a complexity centre to professional curmudgeon, and I'm not too much fussed which you use. And this is the Agile Uprising podcast.
Welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your host, James Gifford, and we're coming to you from Mile High Agile's conference in sunny Denver today. We'd like to, when we have the opportunity to get out on location to do some of these podcasts with the community. So, you know, we were happy to, you know, have the space and the ability to have such a great group of people. And for this episode, we have Trent Hone with us, and we're going to be discussing his book that he put out about a year ago on the organizational learnings in the U.S. Navy in the first half of the 20th century. So welcome, Trent.
Yeah, great. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So you put this book out last year. Around what time a year did we?
It came out in June last year, and the title, you've covered the subject very well, but the title's Learning War, and it's about innovation and learning in the United States Navy. I study the Navy, or I approach it, through the lens of complexity. So there are a number of different avenues that are very applicable to us in the Agile space. One is organizational learning, because we strive to contribute to that and promote it. And the other one is how do we prompt it? What are some of the structures or routines that we can put in place to make it faster and more effective? And I use a complexity frame to try to elucidate that and draw out some lessons from the Navy's experience.
So how did you, that's interesting. Like, but how did you kind of, what drew you to the Navy? Are you like a former service member, or like what got you inspired to like look at the Navy for this type of like learnings?
That's an excellent question. So I've been a student of history of the Navy for a long time. And it's only recently, though, probably the last 5 or 6 years, that I've been able to draw some threads together. You know, I've been in Agile coaching for a while, since about 2009 or something like that, and very interested in how organizations learn, what kind of structures they put in place to do that, and how we can organize to do it more effectively. So that's been my professional background. And that began to align with my historical research when I moved beyond just looking at what the Navy had done and how it had done it, to think more about what are the structures that they put into place, what are the kinds of things that they did. And I noticed that some of the techniques that they were employing, the terms aren't the same, but they resonate with some of the things that we're trying to do today in modern organizations, where we're trying to make them more agile, where we're trying to allow learning to happen faster and more rapidly, and allow it to bubble up from lower levels to be then successfully transformative for the broader organization.
That's really cool. And so I guess there are a lot of, like, I guess, are you looking at like different documentaries and or books, or like how did you come up with these different threads? Like, I'm just curious. Like,
oh, sure. Some of it, you know, my early interest, of course, was prompted by a lot of secondary source research. I played war games with my father as a kid. He studied this kind of thing as well. But then it was towards the end of the 90s, I was on an internet message board, and someone had a question on there. This wasn't just a group of enthusiasts. There were some real historians on there as well. And the question came up, suppose that the United States hadn't been drawn into World War II the way it had been. Suppose the Japanese Empire hadn't attacked Pearl Harbor. What would the United States Navy have done? How would it have approached a war in the Pacific? And no one had a good answer. There were answers at the strategic level, but no answers at a lower sort of tactical level. And we had some old microfilm that charted through, the Navy went through a series of exercises in the 20s and 30s. They were called fleet problems, large comprehensive exercises, about one every year. And we had the records of those on microfilm from the National Archives. And I thought, well, if I dig back into those, maybe I can figure that out. And that led to an article that was published in 2003, and I just kept pulling on the thread ever since then.
That's interesting. So what kind of, you know, so how do you, So then, I guess, does your book relate this back to Agile then?
It does. It does. It tries to draw out some of the concepts that we can use. I talk a lot about constraints. That's where the complexity theory comes in. And those of you who are familiar with Kinevin and the work of Dave Snowden and that group will have some understanding of how he talks about constraints. His approach there is very influenced by the work of the philosopher Alicia Guerrero. And I was fortunate enough to have, she lives in the DC region as well as I do. And so we had a lot of back and forth as I was putting the book together. And she kept encouraging me to think about these things in terms of, you know, what is the system? How do these constraints act on agents, individuals within the system? And how does this induce changes in behavior? And so I tried to use that frame. And she classifies constraints into two basic categories. There are those constraints that sort of operate or interact with agents at the same level who are creating the constraints. And she calls these enabling constraints. These would be like norms that an Agile team would create, right? We'd get together and we'd talk about how do we want to interoperate. But once those things begin to manifest, right, once they create a new way of behaving, they can foster emergence through that mechanism. And then they act more as a top-down or a governing constraint, right? So once we name these values that we're going to live by as a team, they then influence our behavior. They exert behavior back down on us. And so there's this system of constraints where they can emerge, foster new innovative behavior, and then promote further constraint on the system as it goes forward. And so I talked about how that process occurs in the Navy of the early 20th century. And you can see how it builds on itself as they learn more things and introduce new techniques.
That is super interesting. And, you know, it'll definitely be interesting to dive into that. And it's, so the thing that I kind of, you know, I try to talk to our organizations about systems thinking, and that the entire organization is a system, whether it's people banging on a keyboard to get code into production, to ideas, to how we, the different management systems and things like that. So do you guys look at, like, do you look at those constraints from like different classifications and how you might address certain constraints in various parts of the system versus?
Yeah, one of the things that I talk about is how it's very important to frame something at a high level with the right kind of specificity. So one of the things that was very important for the Navy during this time was they came up with a new approach or a more standardized approach for creating orders for people. You know, it's a hierarchical organization. Orders need to flow from the top down. But one of the things that they realized was if we're too specific about it, that inhibits the creativity of people at lower levels. And in a very dynamic situation, not unlike some of the Agile software teams that we have, if you're too specific, then that'll channelize people into behavior that's going to be less than ideal. You need to allow them the freedom to react. So how do we do this? And one of the things that they noticed, they didn't use the terms that we would use today, but they had to be give sufficient direction, sort of frame the problem appropriately, but then allow enough freedom in terms of how it's been framed to allow exploration and solution at lower levels. And it's really fascinating to go through the history and see how they wrestled with that, because we wrestle with the same kinds of things today.
Well, I guess, I mean, so, and that's something that we definitely see today. And last year, we went on a whole company-wide leadership initiative to take some of David Marquet's work with
intent-based
leadership,
mm-hmm.
and teach the management about driving decision-making down to the lowest responsible level.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, you need to make sure that they have the clarity and the technical competency to kind of get that done.
Yep.
And that's, you know, that's kind of where it's interesting is how much clarity, like, what is that constraint of clarity? And how do you find that baseline of at this level of the organization with these people, with their skill sets, with like maybe their levels of education or things like that? Like, how do you understand what those constraints look like around like even providing them clarity? Because they may not get the big picture up here.
Yeah.
That if you would take that big picture that's way up in the organization and you try to disseminate that to the teams, that they're going to look at you like, I don't know.
Yeah, it's much too high, right?
So, like, how did the Navy kind of like work their way through that? Like, that I think that's an interesting dynamic because I think a lot of organizations struggle with that kind of same paradigm.
One of the things that they hit on that I think resonates a lot with things that we do today is they call it the estimate of the situation, which was sort of a problem-solving framework with a series of steps. And it's similar to the canvases we use today, although it was briefer. They never described it as a canvas. It never had any sort of visualization associated with it. But it was just, okay, so you're going to get some sort of problem or challenge from a higher group. You need to kind of restate that, frame the problem in your own terms, and then look at the landscape. Usually this was phrased in a military context. You're looking at what are our capabilities, what are the potential enemy capabilities. So you could look at that as, let's make sense of the environment. What can we do? What could be done to us? And then walk through different options. You know, deliberately see, oh, we could do this, we could do this, we could do this, and then analyze each one of those to see which one is going to generate the best fit and ultimately decide on an action. And the neat thing about it is they designed it to be fractal so that each piece of the hierarchy would walk through this. They'd walk through the same steps, and the output of one step would feed into the step or the group next level down, which begins to address the problem that you were just speaking to, which is, okay, if we take the overall strategic direction of the organization and we feed that down to the lowest level team, they're going to look at us like, we don't have power to do that, right? So you need to cascade it somehow. They found a way to cascade it.
And it's usually that cascading process that isn't very, like, it, if you ever, it's, you know, you, depending if you have that problem in the organization where people are, you know, playing the game. Like, where? How do I get myself up to the next rung of that corporate ladder that some of those, that big organizational strategy that was supposed to be awesome gets diluted or
yeah, you know, and sometimes warped into a strategy that's good for that individual. Or that individual's department, right? Then we see a local optimization, which is negative for the overall context.
So it's... Yeah. Like, but it's interesting, like, how, like, I guess, do you have some tips or ideas around how to make that cascading process safe? Like, how do you keep the game, how do you keep it from being mutated on its way down the rungs of a corporation?
That's a really good question. One thing that I think is important that we don't do enough in organizations today, or at least I don't think we do, is practice this. So... are there opportunities that we can create, like an offsite or maybe even an afternoon workshop where we practice it? Bring people in from the different levels, do this kind of framing with a hypothetical exercise, and see what comes out. What do we learn through that exercise? Are we crafting things that appear to be at the right level? So cascade it down through the exercise, and then provide feedback back up about whether or not the way we structured it made sense. Because I think practice is a really effective way to begin to draw out some of these ideas. That is something that is different from the Navy situation in this time period. Because if we think about it, you know, the time period that I cover is primarily the end of the Spanish-American War through the end of World War II. Most of that was periods of peace. So the Navy doesn't have to be fighting anyone. It can practice. And particularly between World War I and World War II, it spent a lot of time practicing, getting officers more capable at framing problems this way to give sufficient flexibility and room for exploration among subordinates.
I mean, it's kind of interesting that you talk, like you mentioned, practice. And, you know, it's probably something that's kind of missing in our industry is getting people, you know, everybody wants to run before they can walk and they crawl. We talk with a lot of teams about, like, let's just get the basic fundamentals down right. I know you think you've mastered the stand-up, but from an outsider looking in, it still looks like a status meeting. Like, it's not a planning meeting where you come in and you're like, okay, I can get this done, but I'm going to need Billy to spend, like, 20 minutes with me to explain this thing. And then when I get done with that, I can work with you, Bob, on getting your thing done. And there's still their stand-up is, I worked on ticket 4 today. I'm going to continue to work it on ticket 4 today. And when I finish that up, I'm going to pick up ticket 6. I have no impediments.
Right.
And so, like, people do need practice. They do need to build that muscle memory. And that's why, you know, and David talked about a lot in his book about running drills.
Yeah.
And it being necessary to run through drills. And I think that, you know, looking at some of those, even with working with, like, development teams, like, we've just kind of recently started talking about with some of the groups running, like, I mean, you know, other companies have been doing it for years with the Chaos Monkey and different things, like, just go in and blow up the system and see how people react to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, we need to figure out how to build resiliency into the organization. And through doing that, not even resiliency of, like, the systems, just the resiliency of the people. Of the people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's one of the things that we've been trying to kind of figure out is how we build resiliency in the organization. So when a team does fail and they get knocked down and we're there saying, hey, it's okay, you failed.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, what did you learn from that? Like,
right. Yeah.
Can you get back up? So, mm-hmm. like, how did, like, so they're the Navy's doing these drills and things like that. Like, how did that kind of influence where they went from there? Because they were in peacetime.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the other things that I think is really remarkable to a modern audience, like I've talked to a number of different naval audiences about this. Like, a couple months ago, I was at the Naval War College lecturing about it. And after they did these exercises, so they're pretty significant, large exercises, they would bring the bulk of the fleet together for it. They would get all the commanding officers together and have essentially a retrospective. They wouldn't call it that. It'd be more like a debrief. But it would take the form of what we would be familiar with as a retrospective. Everybody would share their thoughts. They'd make sense of what happened together. I think there's a couple keys to that. One, they were very interested in making sure that the knowledge that was being gained or the experiences that were being learned, even from relatively low levels, were bubbling back up, feeding back into the system. And the other one is they're setting aside some deliberate time to reflect on things. Because you were talking about, hey, we don't take enough time potentially in our industry to practice. I think oftentimes we don't take enough time to reflect. And I'm meaning here not just the kind of retrospective that most teams will typically do after an iteration or after a set amount of time, but really kind of like thinking deeply about how are things going and how am I learning new things as an individual and then as a team. I think there's a depth to that reflection that we can amplify. So those are things that I think are really, really important there. And through that process, they would identify experiments that had been tried in the prior exercises, and any successful ones would get incorporated for, like, the next exercise, or maybe a new updated manual or something like that. So they would modify and recodify their procedures on a regular basis so that they could get better.
That's interesting. You know, we do, like, our company kind of believes that you know, we are looking for global effectiveness over local optimization.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the things are is, you know, we run into situations where we may need to evolve our methodology and the way we kind of do things. And so we do plan experiments. And it's like, all right, well, here, we've run this. It was successful here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's now expand it to the next product and see what happens there.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, hey, it didn't totally blow up, but we did find a nuance. So mm-hmm. now you found group A ran it this way and it was perfectly fine. Group B ran it this way and it was totally fine with these four things that we needed to kind of address or change in our messaging. So now let's take these adjustments back to group A.
Yeah.
And see if that blows them up.
Mm-hmm.
And then so we kind of go through this this back and forth until we can find a stable state where, all right, now this is the go forward. And this is how we kind of bring the rest of the people along with it.
Yeah, expand it from group A and group B to everybody else.
Or in the case where we may need, or where we have the luxury of, freedom, like, we do try to get it focused on a set of outcomes. Like,
mm-hmm.
here are the outcomes that, like, of this planning process. Here's your 10 outcomes that you need to walk away from with this planning exercise. We don't care what you do in between,
mm-hmm.
but here are these outcomes.
Here's the outcome.
So we've kind of started to find that balance of where do we need structure, rigor, repetitiveness, and then where is it, like, here are the outcomes,
mm-hmm.
and here's the timeline. Like, each outcome needs to be accomplished within a set of parameters. And I think, you know, to some degree, a lot of, you know, if you hear some of the military, they focus on those objectives.
Right. Yeah.
At least in a lot of the modern military mm-hmm. stuff that we've kind of been reading about, trying to bring it back circle. But it's, you know, is there anything in the Navy around, like, so they were running these experiments, they would incorporate them. Would they run it again, though, to validate that it was successful, or did it just kind of become a thing?
Often it would get run multiple times, maybe not quite as deliberately as we might in our organization today, because you're talking about framing experiments and crafting hypotheses and everything else. This would be a little bit more ad hoc. They probably wouldn't have called them experiments, but I'm framing them that way because I think it makes sense to us and the listeners. It tended to be a certain amount of time before something got trialed, and maybe a couple years would go by before it got integrated into something that was more specific or more routine. One of the elements that I think was really helpful in promoting this is surprising, I think, to some people today, there's a lot of variability in the Navy back then. They still had this kind of heritage of, well, each captain has his own ship, and each captain can run his own ship any way that he wants to. And obviously with his subordinates, as executive officer and other chief subordinates, he's going to figure out how to do that. And the same held true for different organizations, collections of ships. So they would be trying different ideas out to a certain degree to try to compete with each other in these exercises, because a lot of them were open-ended and they're contested. And your career depends somewhat on how well you do in these exercises. And so you're motivated to try to find new approaches and new techniques. One way in which this really triggered a lot of effective learning was in the early 20th century, the Navy was experimenting, this is before World War I, with how to aim and fire the guns of its ships at much longer ranges. And there was an experiment performed that showed that you could control the guns from high up in a ship. And then they said, okay, well, we're going to increase the challenge of the exercises, and we're going to let the ships figure out how best to do that. How are they going to set up the control mechanisms to make sure that that is effective and possible? So, in essence, every different ship in the fleet is competing against every other different ship in the fleet to do best. And that all those parallel experiments led to new and more effective techniques.
But if you got all these different, like, I mean, that sounds to me like semi-organized chaos. Like, if you got all these different people competing, everybody's trying to play the, you know, run their experiments to be the best I can possibly be at these exercises, so my job can be successful. At what point does, like, how do you, like, if everybody's running it their own way, how do you eventually bring all that local optimization back to something that's cohesively rolloutable across the, you know, whole force of naval vessels?
Oh, that's an excellent question. And I think this is an area that gets a little uncomfortable for, like, the Navy today, which is much more centralized, and a lot of our organizations, because we've got this emphasis on the efficiency. Right? We don't want to waste a lot of time exploring these different ideas. We don't want to encourage local sub-optimizations. And the way that they would do it is, obviously, there's a result of the exercises every year, and they would periodically staff a board, a collection of individuals who knew a lot about this area, to assess what was being done in the different ships within the fleet and make recommendations about what should become standardized. And one of the things that I think is neat about that is that that wouldn't happen, it would happen on a regular basis, but with broader intervals than I think we would often be comfortable with today. So, like, maybe every 2 years they get together, because, you know, the pace of technology is a little bit slow if you're talking about a ship and their routines. It's not like an agile team. It's not like building software. So we would want to do that more frequently. But I think that pattern of periodically going through, assessing what's been working, and then grabbing the most effective bits and exploring how to proceed is a useful model.
I find that interesting. I mean, but yeah, I mean, naval technology, some of those ships have been the same basically until they're retired.
Well, the hulls are more or less the same, at least on most of them. But the technology is changing surprisingly rapidly during this period. And I think that's one of the reasons the Navy invested in this kind of approach, was because there was a lot of uncertainty about how best to make some of these new technologies, or new at the time, new technologies work. This is an era where computing devices, mechanical computing devices, are being introduced.
I guess you're right.
So before, naval officers would have to calculate the movements of a ship that they were trying to shoot at by hand, you know, create a manual plot, do some logarithmic calculations using a slide rule or in their head, and then make estimates that way. And they're starting to figure out, and some of the talented officers are actually starting to create machines that they can use on their ship, calculating devices, to try to make it easier for them to do well in these exercises. And some of those machines then get manufactured and adopted by other ships.
That's interesting. That's very interesting.
Yeah, you could almost think of it as like, innovation. Hey, I made this cool tool that automates part of our deployment process. Do you other teams want to use it? And we do that all the time now. It's very similar.
Heck yeah. The industry's, we've made a whole industry out of helping people get code into production. Yeah. You know, it is definitely interesting. And you know, I guess it's much, so I guess the Navy treated their boats exactly like the airplane industry does, and just the shell stays the same, but we keep upgrading the guts.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's interesting. In some of the research in that you did it get into like some of the different evolutions of the machines, and like maybe the you know, ship finder calculator machine on this boat, how it evolved, did they ever like figure out like two different people created the same thing and then those people get together?
Oh, there's a lot of competition in these kinds of early computing devices. And there are at the time, the Navy had these different bureaus that were responsible for different technical areas of expertise. So they had one called the Bureau of Ordnance, which was responsible for these things and for guns and stuff like that. And they outsourced a lot of the work to different technology firms, a lot of them in New York City. Like there was the Sperry Gyroscope Company. They invented a gyrocompass that could, you know, maintain course a lot better than alternatives on the market, better than magnetic compasses. And Sperry, the name of the guy who founded the company, was very interested in creating these kinds of devices. And the Navy bought some of them. Didn't buy them all, because some of them, you know, they try them out and like, well, you know, this doesn't really work in our circumstances. And then there were competition. Sperry worked with a gentleman named Ford, not the Ford auto manufacturer, but a different guy named Hannibal Ford. And he branched off, started his own company, and made the most successful of the computing devices that the Navy used. They called it the Rangekeeper.
What did it do?
It keeps track of the motions of a potential target ship and the firing ship, and computes automatically how those ships are going to move in time based on past observations. One of the things that was really neat about the early devices is Ford understood that he had to make a user interface that was very sophisticated and gave one person the ability to make sense of what the computing device was saying and how it related to actual observations. So it gave the operator an ability to compare the predicted motions with the observed motions and then bring them back into line very quickly, which is something that other devices that solved the same kind of problem around the world at the same time, like the one used by the Royal Navy, didn't do. And so that was one of the reasons why the Navy thought it was very effective.
It's like a Monte Carlo simulation for blowing stuff up.
It has some parallels to that.
That's where my brain kept going, was Monte Carlo simulation. And that's totally interesting, because it's like, how many we want teams to look at past observations and learn. You know, it's part of like our retrospectives and gathering data and mm-hmm. you know, having those communities of practitioners that we all run around with, and being able to take their observations and learning, because we all, you know, ironically, at some point in time, we all run into the same darn situation. So it's, you know, it's kind of interesting, kind of see all those parallels. So what else? We've got the competition. What else? A lot of innovation coming mm-hmm. out.
A lot of exploring. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of willingness to hold the space open for a while and not gravitating towards a solution right away. So resisting the urge to identify the solution right now in preference of maintaining the space, creating more options so that, well, it's akin to committing at the last responsible moment, but here more from a technology or techniques perspective, less from a like a user story or a feature.
Cool.
But a similar idea.
So how have you taken all these different learnings, and I'm sure we still have a bunch more to kind of, we can go diving into. But so how have you kind of taken all these different observations and then turned it into like the complexity model that we kind of originally kind of started?
I use that as a frame to explain it. So I talk a lot about constraints, and I look at the regular pattern of exercises, right? So if we're thinking about the gunnery exercises, there's a gunnery competition every year. If we're thinking about the larger fleet exercises, there was one of those about every year, and that was the culmination of a series of exercises. And so there's this pattern of constraint where we're always going to have to compete. So that's one level of constraint. The fact that it occurs on a regular basis gives us an opportunity for feedback. How did we do in those challenges, in those exercises? There's motivation to do well in that because the promotion system is relatively constrained, right? You can't just have as many naval officers as you want. Congress imposes limits. So to reach the higher ranks, you are motivated to outcompete some of your peers. So there's a variety of constraints around that. I also frame the idea of orders as constraints, right? So you want to establish that kind of direction or constraint at the right level to encourage sufficient self-organization at the lower ranks. And I think that the fire control problem or how to hit a moving target is a good one of those. Like, we know we're going to centralize it aboard the ship. We know we're going to control it from higher in the ship, but we don't know how we're going to do it. So ships go figure it out. So that becomes then a constraint. Hey, we're going to figure out how to do this, but we don't know the details yet. We're going to have to explore.
We need to centrally locate how to make things go boom. Which is, I mean, that's awesome. And, you know, I think, I mean, we talk, like, so, like, there are, I mean, you brought up Kinefin and the constraints within Kinefin. Do you see, like, and then now you're talking about your own set of, like, kind of your constraints and your formulation around constraints. How, you know, for our listeners, how do we keep all these kind of different ideas around constraints? Because we also then talk about the theory of constraints.
Oh, theory of constraints, yes,
and so
another one.
Now we've got all these different constraints kind of flowing around. Do they all live together in like the big happy constraint family bucket? Or, like, how do we keep these things all kind of different? And, like, so from an organizational standpoint, like, if I'm trying to talk to a leader,
mm-hmm.
and I'm talking about the flow, the value stream, and how we need to remove these constraints from, you know, either product management or the governance process, that's one thing.
Yeah.
But then there are the constraints around the complexity of the work that we do, and, like, so how do we kind of approach this and the discussion of constraints with leaders? Because it could all, like, all of a sudden now my head is thinking, like, theory of constraints, Kinefin, this, oh my God, there's a whole new set of constraints. my brain blew up.
I think it's very easy to create confusion with this and around the topic of constraints. Some of the people, I have a regular call with some friends who are pretty familiar with the complexity frame that I used, and sometimes we vent a little bit about how the term constraint can be used in a lot of different ways, and sometimes it's used in a way that is close enough to how I'm trying to use it, but just confuses people. So one of the things that I try to emphasize, I mean, I'm being very frank about what I did in the book, but, like, if I'm talking to leaders in an organization, I shy away from the term constraint and try to be more specific about the kinds of behavior that I want them to embrace. Because constraint is loaded. We often think of constraint, at least most of the leaders and organizations that I talk to, think of it in terms of how it inhibits things. We're starting to see more about how it can encourage certain behaviors, like, you know, channelize kind of behaviors by producing effective guardrails so we create room for self-organization. But I try to use those kinds of terms. Like, hey, don't impose too small of a box on the team because then they won't have room to get creative. Give them enough room to explore the most effective solution. Right? And I talked about what you and I were just talking about. I didn't use the word constraint.
There you go.
I'm talking about a constraint, but I didn't use the word because I think sometimes it just begins to confuse things.
Well, and that's, you know, we have a lot of, you know, it's we're kind of working in this I work for this organization right now, and me and my boss talk about forced confusion.
Ooh, I like that term.
And it's like people, given the opportunity, people will force themselves to be confused around any kind of situation. Like, so if we were, you know, we were talking about we were talking about this whole cultural like initiative that we wanted to do, where we were basically trying to get people to double down on like valuing accountability and collaboration, which kind of tied sort of to our corporate goals.
Okay.
Or not corporate goals, but corporate values. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we split our performance reviews into the what and the how.
Mm.
So it doesn't matter what you deliver if you burn down the organization while you're doing it. Like, the whole goal is that you find a balance of like the what and the how. So You're still delivering on, you're delivering cool stuff. You can set goals around that. Mm-hmm. But how you got it there? Did you bring people along? Was it collaborative?
Mm.
And we were getting ready to launch this initiative, and it was like, well, if we bring this out now, since some of this stuff relates to how the how works,
mm-hmm.
and some of the more of the depth of the goals we're trying to, we were like, people, there were definitely leaders in our organization that would be like, I'm so confused. Am I supposed to be managing it towards your set of values or what's in the how guide today? And it's like they would force themselves to be confused on, even though it was two clear messages.
Hmm.
And so we keep running into some of these ideas of like people forcing themselves to be confused about a change because they don't like it or they don't understand it or too afraid to ask a question and look dumb in front of their peers. So they force themselves to be confused about the situation.
That's really interesting. It makes me think of something else that I talk about in the book. I bring up heuristics, the same way that Daniel Kahneman uses them, you know, from thinking fast and thinking slow. The idea that a heuristic is sort of a problem solving rubric that we use primarily subconsciously, and it finds its way into our consciousness through habit, right? So we can create new decision heuristics if we create patterns around them. And I often try to encourage teams to be kind of deliberate about that, which gets back to exercises and practice. And so what you made me think of is that this new approach, this sort of confusion that is being created, probably has its roots in the fact that it rubs against some established heuristics that, you know, these leaders in your organization have. You know, they're used to doing things a certain way, and this does not map to that way, so now I'm confused.
Yeah.
Now I don't know what to do. Which is wonderful, because it gets back to the problem of how do we promote effective change that is sustainable? And how do we bring people along with that? It's part of your how.
It is. And it's absolutely interesting to kind of go through that, because, you know, we're talking through a whole paradigm shift of, while we're a development manager is not directly accountable for delivery anymore.
Mm.
They still need to be responsible and make sure that it's happening, but they're not solely accountable for it. Like, they need to make the teams are now accountable for it, but you need to be there to,
yeah,
kind of shepherd that along. Mm-hmm. And it's like your job is now about making sure you have the right people, and
yeah,
your people have the right skills. And so it's like this big paradigm shift of, like, we're now wanting you to be a coach and a mentor and focus less on firefighting. And so now you've got this whole management crew that are, you know, they got there because there was at one point in time no career ladder to go past like senior developer.
Oh, yeah.
And the only path was over to management. So, you know, mm-hmm. you got all these people that were awesome developers and now they're managers and they don't have necessarily some of the skills they need. So it's, you know, it's some of those paradigms and patterns are just like,
yeah,
okay, well, admit that you don't have the skills and we're willing to invest in you. Like, we're up front. Like, if you need help, like,
I think that is I went through that. You know, I was a developer that was a good developer, started to lead developers, switched over to management. And I remember that being very difficult to make that transition effectively, right? Because you are accustomed to being very hands-on, being part of the work. And now all of a sudden, you have to be responsible for an ecosystem that enables the delivery of the work rather than the delivery of it yourself. That was quite the transition.
It always is. It definitely is. Well, we're coming up on our time box. So if people want to get a hold of you, Trent, and figure out how, like, and learn more about this or where to pick up your book, or if there's anything you want to promote, upcoming talking points, whatever, you know, we want to give you this time to kind of it's time for Trent to shine.
All right. Well, the book again is called Learning War. It's on the Naval Institute's website. They're the publishers. It's also on Amazon. I've got a website, Trent Hone, TrentHone.com. I post things there occasionally, and also have a link to the book as well as some of the different reviews on it. I got a very favorable review from Tom Ricks in the New York Times last fall, which is pretty cool.
That's awesome.
And it's also been embraced by the current naval community because it resonates with things that they're trying to achieve. The current Chief of Naval Operations, John Richardson, has been talking about high-velocity learning and the need for it. And he likes to highlight my book as a way in which the Navy did this in the past, and that signals they can do it again. But I think it's true not just for the Navy, it's any organization that wants to learn faster. And I think there are principles that are generally applicable.
Awesome. So if people want to get in contact with you, how would they, would it be Twitter, LinkedIn, email?
Twitter's really good. My Twitter handle is Honer, H-O-N-E-R _cut, C-U-T. It has its roots in an old Frisbee team I used to play on. And and then also my email address is on the on my website. And I'm with a company called Excella, which is in Arlington, Virginia. They've got a website too, excella.com. You can reach me that way.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to kind of, you know, share this information with us. I'm gonna pick up your book and we'll go through it in a little bit more detail. And I think we should probably maybe have a follow up.
Oh, I think that'd be
after,
great.
After we get some more things, you know, picked out of it.
Cool.
So really appreciate your time. And so from sunny Denver, this is the Agile Uprising kind of signing out.
Membership fees apply after free trial. Cancel any time.
Okay, so why do people love my Total Body Bar workouts? Because they work. My clients get an amazing workout and great results. I'm Andrea Rogers, professional dancer and trainer, and my Extend Bar classes are fun, only 30 minutes, and proven to help you get sculpted, lean, and strong. And right now, you can stream my Extend Bar classes for free on the Beachbody On Demand app. See how effective these workouts truly are. Start for free today at beachbody.com.